This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
If we have a victim and we have a perpetrator, does a conviction automatically follow? This is but one of the conundrums addressed in Robin Dennison's novel In Plain Sight. So, Robin, welcome to 3CR.
Hello, thank you for having me.
There's a very delicate issue at the heart of this novel. What is the crime and who are the victims here?
So the crime is the discovery of child abuse material, and the victims are two nearly 18-year-old identical twins named Lucy and Violet.
But the actual crime, when did that occur?
About 4 or 5 years before the narrative takes place.
Yeah, so these are pictures of Lucy and Violet when they were 13, 14,
yes.
And they're now 17 going on 18. But there are multiple complications, psychological and practical, when it comes to the twins, Lucy and Violet. Now, an individual can decide if they want to report a crime or not, but that's challenged when you have twins. How so?
I think it's a theme throughout the novel, the tension between not only who the twins are and their very different personalities, but what they each want. And playing with that tension is a big part of the plot and the investigation and the speed bumps along the way.
But when a sex crime is committed, it can only be acted upon when the victim makes a written statement. So if the twins don't want to behave in one accord, what coercion manipulation is there between the two?
And what level of, at what point are the police helping versus harming?
Yeah, that's there as well. But okay, they're now 17, going on 18, and they're sexually active young women. But how much of what happened in the past is now influencing their conduct now? Because especially Violet, she's very forthright in her conduct and behaviour, and there is manipulation and coercion and all sorts of interplay going on here. It's a challenging question. How much of what happened in the past might be influencing their conduct now?
Yeah, I think that's a question for every character, and I think even every person. How much the past affects who we are and how we behave.
Yeah. So it's quite hurtful. At one point, Violet takes somebody that a friend has an interest in, and all of this sort of thing. So there's manipulation, coercion.
Yes, Violet's definitely a character who, not to psychoanalyze or be too didactic about it, but to my mind, Violet is a character who asserts power through acts of control and manipulation. Yeah. And that's how she has a sense of self.
But then when the abuse occurred at 13 or 14, Lucy is the main victim, is what I get the sense of. But at that age, 13, 14, they're discovering their sexuality and what is and isn't appropriate. But the same questions still apply when they're 17 and 18.
Yes, yeah. It's very complicated territory.
Indeed it is. The two primary investigators on this case are Detective Senior Constable Lara Wilton, who is returning to her hometown of Birchwood, and Sergeant Ben Voigt, and they went to school together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that poses a bit of a problem.
A little bit.
Well, the power differentiation here, what's going on?
Well, yeah, because who's really in charge? Because technically Ben outranks Lara, but she's specialised, and so there's a push-pull there for sure.
And also you get a male-female dynamic.
Yes, and Ben feels guilty about things from the past, which makes him deferential.
So there's something where Lara has been made a victim in the past. Can Ben be held to account or blame for that? Because it happened when they were at school.
And that's a question. And without getting into spoiler territory,
But again, it's that same dynamic of what happened in the past to Lucy and Violet. What happens in the past influences how you interact today. there's also a problem internally within the Child Abuse and Sex Crimes Unit with Detective Senior Constable Christian Haas. Now, what's going on there?
So as the novel begins, Lara is reeling from a discovery that a very close colleague of hers has been accused of, you know, kind of inappropriately accessing the database that they have for their investigations that contain illegal material.
And this is a theme or a trope that is occurring throughout the novel, because the reason this abuse, initial abuse to Lucy and Violet came up, is because of an accidental discovery in the first place. A USB has been found with incriminating, photographs, etc., which Emil puts onto his computer, but destroys the USB. So how do you account for that initial behaviour? Does it cast doubt on what Christian Haas has done?
I personally don't think so. I guess it depends on how you interpret it. Certainly I was interested in exploring the complexities behind how people think about this kind of offending related to child abuse material, and to what extent people don't think of it as particularly harmful if they're just happening upon it, or if they're, you know, and that's obviously a fairly misguided way to think about it, because regardless of whether you're committing a contact offence or not, it's, you're creating a market for something that is quite horrific. And that's one of the things I wanted to explore in the novel, was exactly those kind of ambiguities around the different types of offending and the different types of situations that people find themselves in that lead to their offending.
Because that ambiguity continues later in the novel when a hard drive found that implicates others. But also now we get the subject of men and sex, which I think you handle very sympathetically. So, for example, Ben and his wife, Danny, and their relationship, and you've got a scene where Ben is actually unable to perform. But what's the challenge he's facing here?
Yeah, I mean, Ben is having a little bit of a crisis because for a long time he and his wife have been planning to start a family, and now they've been trying for a number of months and it's not been happening. And every kind of month that it doesn't happen, Ben kind of becomes increasingly unsure if it's actually what he wants after all. And I think I think that's just a really interesting dilemma to have in a relationship.
But in terms of a novel and sex scenes in a novel and the dynamic, I mean, he's having performance anxiety, he's stressed at work, it's very real. But also then you've got Lucy's boyfriend, Evan. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think he follows the stereotypical norm, because how's Evan behaving and working with Lucy?
Yes, he's quite a... It's definitely important to me to not have anything ever adhere to a stereotype, for sure. Yes.
Yeah, because he's quite sympathetic and helpful and understanding, even though
as
he's...
many men are.
Thank you. Yes, well done. But again, even that initial crime, Emil Johnson has found the USB and he sort of puts it on his computer and then destroys the USB. He's sort of rather shamefaced. He's not an aggressive perpetrator of a crime, but he's implicated.
Yeah, and I think it's a bit of a myth that anyone who commits these kinds of offences is violent or aggressive or actively wanting to harm children. And I think when we as a society lie to ourselves that, you know, we can kind of put it in a safe box of anyone who does that is scary and violent and evil, and so we don't have to confront the ugly reality that it's actually a lot more nuanced than that, and that every single person in the world, whether they commit child sex crimes or not, is a human with their own story.
And each of the characters within this novel has their own backstory and their own current ongoing challenges with relationships, which is very realistic and ambiguous. But now, just as with any good detective mystery, it's not just the initial crime. There are things that occur later on. But you've handled this as well in an unstereotypical way. We have a body turn up. Now, we can't say too much here, in terms of who the body is, I don't think, to give a...
No, no, we won't.
We won't, because that'll give too much of the story away. But there's an uncertainty here.
Yes.
Drugs, murder, accident, we don't know.
Yeah.
But also then, with this investigation, do we ever find out?
You'll have to read the book.
But that notion of uncertainty is going all the way through.
Yes.
In terms of the nature of the initial crime and who was involved, with the nature of these individuals and what has influenced them.
Mm.
Another element here with the investigation, is it harassment? Because if a statement, a paper statement hasn't been made, if a verbal statement has been given, which can't therefore be used necessarily, are the investigators guilty of harassment?
That's a really good question, and it's certainly a big theme of the novel, the question of the limitations of the justice system and the question of what feels like justice to a victim versus what the law or society considers to be justice versus, you know, like some people don't, you know, it happens, and I think it's a valid thing to not want to dredge up things from the past, even if... it's for the greater good, probably, if you do. And so I did want to explore that with the girls and feeling like they're already at the centre of, you know, they have a family history and feeling like they've had their fair share of notoriety already and they'd like to just be left alone.
But also the agency, you hold the story yourself. How much of it do you give away? Is it a violation? If you've sort of worked out how you're going to handle what has been done to you, is it a violation? Is an investigation a violation if they're wanting to get you to say what happened to you, given you've already decided how you're going to handle it?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the questions that both the police detectives grapple with throughout the investigation as they try to consider what the morally correct thing to do is versus maybe what the black and white rule on paper would be.
There's also another element we're going to have to finish very shortly, the digital accessibility now of this material. It can be so readily spread around and incriminate people because that what set the investigation off was an accidental discovery.
Yeah.
And that opens up a whole Pandora's box. So I've been talking with Robin Dennison. The novel is In Plain Sight. It's not your usual cut-and-dried detective mystery. There's a harsh reality about inappropriate conduct, along with an ambiguity about the compromises and uncertainties that people face in real life. Robin Dennison, it's In Plain Sight and Text Publishing Release. Jan.
Well, thank you. Well, my book. It's the year 2000. A new century is starting and Victoria Hannan has created a character who's also starting out. But in her case, it's in midlife. In her book, I love the whole world. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you for having me.
This character is Leslie Frances Pester. She's 43 years old, she has a 22-year-old daughter, a sensible job she doesn't hate, and a marriage to Dennis for the last 24 years. So what's changed for her?
I feel like Dennis has changed for Leslie. So Dennis decides to get really into ergonomics and then gets really into this thing called the Alexander Technique, which is all about like quite rigidly moving your body so you look a bit like a robot. And so as Dennis gets more and more rigid, he sort of pulls away from Leslie and she doesn't really have any say in the matter, but their marriage ends in divorce. That's not a spoiler.
It's not.
It's very much what the novel is about.
Well, his teacher in the Alexander Technique has now become his new life partner.
Yes, so Kimberly.
A divorce. Not instigated by her and she doesn't actively take part in it. one thing she does take part in is to fill her time, she enters competitions until she actually won one. Now, as a writer, Victoria Hammond, you could have picked anywhere in the world to send her. Why did you choose this destination?
So Leslie wins a trip to Las Vegas.
Las Vegas.
Which I think is maybe one of the worst places in the world. I went there once in 2017 for one night and I hated it. And my friend and I went to bed early with a packet of M&Ms and we're just like, we need to leave very early tomorrow, never again. But then when I started thinking about where in the world I could send this character, I imagined myself trying to see Vegas through Leslie's eyes, and it felt like a fun, silly challenge, and it sort of made me laugh. So I forced myself to go back to Vegas and do it again.
The competition win was for two people, but her best friend Jenny couldn't go. Dennis's voice had been in her head for 24 years. Leslie knew what he thought of her better than what she thought of herself. So this is from I Love the Whole World. What did she imagine Dennis would have told their daughter?
It'll be too hot for her, too loud, too bright. She doesn't like places like that. She never has. Everything will be so expensive and gambling. Your mother's never taken a risk in her life. She'll be too nervous for the tables. She'll be too scared to even leave the hotel room.
But she goes. She hasn't got a companion to share her thoughts with, only the reader. And we get details of her extensive observations. It took us nearly 25 pages to actually even get to the airport with the things she packed. She's staying at one of the big casinos and, you know, she's not happy, which is what she sees. Page 49.
At a blackjack table, a man in one of those leather jackets you used to see sex offenders wearing on Crime Stoppers tapped the table and was given a card. A bust. The dealer swiped away his chips. Leslie looked at the buy-in number on the side of the table, $50 a hand. She did not understand the thrill of having your money palmed off you like that. She thought the dealer should at least apologise every time she took someone's chips, just to soften the blow a little.
I can't imagine a croupier doing that at any casino. But she really does have this observation and a quirky way to look at things. And as a reader, we become very invested in her life to the point of the narration where we are asked, would you like to know what Leslie ate for lunch? And I'm thinking, yes. She becomes adventurous with food. And some of the highlights are the buffet breakfast. So what is a Denver pancake?
It's a Denver omelette, actually, and it's incredibly delicious. It is. They probably put about 10 eggs in it in America, and it's huge, but it's also got ham, green pepper, and I don't know, something cheap, probably a lot of orange cheese.
And I think it's the pancakes with maple syrup and bacon, which, you know, yeah,
she loses her mind over that.
She does. With the competition win comes some outings and a flicker of excitement. Where is her bus trip to?
So the first place that Leslie gets to go is to the west rim of the Grand Canyon.
Oh. So from page 68, let's hear about how Leslie felt about the Grand Canyon.
Leslie felt the shift of her very essence, as if something was leaving her to make room, and now the grey and brown beauty of the Grand Canyon would live inside her forever. She took the camera out of her bag, out of its case. She turned it on, pointed it towards the snaking river, the layers of rock, and snapped one photo then another. There was no way a photo could capture the way the rocks made her feel, but she snapped another one all the same. Inspired and overwhelmed, click, astounded and astonished, clickety-click.
They talk about the Grand Canyon being powerfully healing, but the one thing that it is, it's hot.
It is hot.
It is so hot. And we have poor Leslie constantly patting her, the sweat off her.
So Leslie is 43 years old and just in the grips of perimenopause, which means that she sort of, as Dennis got more in control of his body, Leslie sort of lost control of hers. And so she's there in August, which is when I was there, and it's about 43 to 45 degrees every day in the hot desert sun. There's no shade out there. And so Leslie, like me when I was there, is just sweating from places she didn't know it was possible to sweat.
The best friend, Jenny, has a younger brother, Jeff, who is living in Las Vegas. Why did he leave home 24 years ago?
He left home, he claimed to see the world, but secretly it's because he was a little bit in love with Leslie and she was marrying Dennis and he just couldn't handle it. So he decided to leave, go on holiday, and he never came back.
He's happily married now to the beautiful Carol Ann, and as a kid he was into magic and Leslie always belittled him about it. But he's got a job in Vegas.
He does. So he's working. I never actually say their names, but he's working for Siegfried and Roy, the very famous magicians, with their collection of big cats. So it's mostly tigers and a couple of lions.
And Leslie is a little bit in awe when she gets to meet them.
She does actually get to meet a tiger, and I never thought I would write a novel that had tigers in it, but strange things happen.
Absolutely. Jeff tells about the 22-year-old Leslie he knew as brave and funny. And then page 11 is where we have Leslie thinking about herself.
She tried to remember hope and possibility. She tried to remember youth and happiness, laughing until she cried, sleepovers at Jenny's, cheap beer at the uni bar. She tried. She squeezed up her face, but all she remembered, there was life without Dennis, then there was life with Dennis, and now there was life without Dennis again. Three chapters, or rather three short stories about three different people. Fun young Leslie, boring married Leslie, and now this Leslie, Las Vegas Leslie.
Jeff takes her to the Valley of Fires, 4,000-year-old petroglyphs. It's here that Leslie remembers she loves rocks. What was she going to do before she got married?
So Leslie did a bachelor's degree in art history, and then just before she got married, she was planning to do her honours thesis in American land art, which was something she was really passionate about when she was younger. But slowly throughout their marriage, Dennis convinced her that that was not a serious thing that someone should care about.
You introduced me to these incredible new sculptures, especially one called Michael Heiser. I looked up actually what he did, Dark Negative. Can you explain it?
It's hard to explain. You should probably Google it. It's called Double Negative, and it's two pieces of missing rock from the top of a mountain. So essentially he had the idea that he wanted to explore negative space, and so he excavated two pieces of rock out of this mountain in Nevada that are about the size of the Empire State Building each.
Apparently you can see them from space, yep. These two trenches.
They are big trenches. And a lot of people would argue that that doesn't sound like art, but I think it's amazing.
It is special art, because I Googled also how you got there, and it costs $300 a night to stay there just to see the dugout trenches. Anyway, Robert Smithson, who did spiral jets in Utah, that was also interesting.
Yeah, so Robert Smithson has this amazing spiral jetty in a salt lake just north of Salt Lake City. And you can still go out and see it, and it's just rocks in the shape of a spiral jetty. It's exactly what it says it is, but it's just so beautiful.
And then there's Walter Damaris's Field of Lightning Rods in New Mexico.
Yeah, so that is, again, exactly as it sounds, a field with that just has hundreds of rods in it, and you can go and watch the lightning storms.
So the realism she found in modern art had been quashed with Dennis's attitudes towards it. But now, how could she reignite this imagination and courage she had exited from her life?
She was reminded by Jeff about her passion for it, and encouraged by Jeff's wife, Carol Ann, to explore more of it. And then Jeff realised that Double Negative was not too far from the Valley of Fires, and so they got to go and visit it. And it was a really monumental turning point in Leslie's life, I think.
This is a quote. She'd never felt a high like this before, and she realised that maybe it was happiness. If it wasn't heat stroke and alcohol, then it was definitely happiness. She's astonished at the world. She has this contagious enthusiasm. Now, well, thank you to Victoria Hammond. There are other things I learned along with Leslie. Why brides have wedding bouquets?
Yeah, apparently it's because they all used to stink so bad that they had to have a little bouquet of like rosemary or something so that the groom couldn't smell them.
Las Vegas has so many kidney dialysis machines. It's one of these.
I think that's actually just true of America in general. They are everywhere, and it's partly due to their terrible health system, but also just due to the amount of people in kidney failure.
And the big question, and we don't have to answer this on air, but what is a good kind of Christian?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that one.
There was twice in this book that I actually laughed out loud. One involving Dennis, a whole, well, segment, and the other with the pictorial ability to write absence. You'll have to get into the book to see that. Your last two books, Victoria Hammond, Kokomo and Marshmallow, are different to this one.
Yeah, so my first two books were quite sad. Marshmallow particularly, that was a book about sort of grief and trauma, and I found it quite challenging to write about and then even more challenging to talk about afterwards when I had to promote the book. And so I thought if I was going to do this in my spare time when I had a full-time job, I might as well make it fun for myself. And so I decided to write a book that was full of joy.
And desert.
And desert. And sweating.
And sweating.
And pancakes.
And have you ever travelled anywhere with 22 pairs of undies?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that one too.
Oh my goodness!
You can never have too many underpants. That's my general rule in life.
And not enough bras. Leslie is recently divorced. She lost her husband, Dennis, but wins an all-expenses-paid trip to Las Vegas. Her observations of the people and geography they live in ignite her wonder, as well as her life in Victoria Hannon's novel, I Love the Whole World. Oh, just, it was... It didn't have the complexity of yours, I've got to say, Robin.
But this is Robin's debut adult novel, isn't it, Robin?
Yes, my first novel was young adult fiction.
The complexity here is quite profound. Taking a trope and then not subverting it so much as making it very realistic terms of the uncertainty.
I like Victoria turning two last sad books into a really happy, fun book. And we're barracking for Leslie the whole way.
I don't know whether I identified with the bras and undies, but there you go. I wasn't up to the intellectual demands. But anyway, in plain sight, Robin Dennison, Text Publishing.
And I had Victoria Hannon, I Love the Whole World by Penguin Random House.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.